From the campus of Maharshi University of Management, welcome to the program What's New on Campus from World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM on your dial. Today we have two special guests in the studio, Dr. David Orm Johnson and Alex Green. Dr. David Orm Johnson is no stranger to MUM, having taught here and chaired the psychology department for 20 years, along with his lovely wife, Dr. Rhoda Orm Johnson, who taught and chaired the literature department. Among his many achievements in the field of education, he has published, is a consultant, and is also a fine painter. Probably most known for the pioneering research he has done on meditation and its effects, he has become an expert in this field and is mentioned in many articles, papers, and books on the subject. Welcome, David.
Yes,
thank you. Also with us is Alex Green, man of many talents from organic agriculture to becoming a member of Maharshi's Invincible America course, who will talk to us about paradigm shifts. Welcome, Alex.
Yes.
Now, David, maybe we can begin this conversation by asking, when and how did you first begin your career as a meditator and researcher on meditation, and in particular, transcendental meditation?
Well, like many people, I first heard about transcendental meditation from a friend, which in my case was my best friend from high school.
Every time I saw him, he was into something new, you know, some recreational drug, and then he was into Native American culture. And one day we went to see him in New York, and he was sort of the best version of himself. He was less pretentious, I would say, more productive, more centered. I thought, what are you doing this time? It was transcendental meditation. And at that time, teachers were not readily available. And so after I got my PhD, I was teaching at the University of Texas at El Paso. And I was walking by a bulletin board, and I'm not a bulletin board reader. I don't look at bulletin boards usually. My wife does that. But anyway, something kind of turned my head. It was like some force to look over at this little handwritten note, and it said, "Want to enjoy life more? Lecture on transcendental meditation." I thought, that's what Clint was talking about. So I noted down and checked, you know, three or four times I got the information right, and I dragged my wife and a friend of ours to the lecture. And I decided to start, and I was thinking as I was listening to the lecture, this sounds really good, but you know, they need scientific research. And my training was in experimental psychology. Anyway, I learned, and my wife and our friend decided they'd wait and see what happened to me. Well, that afternoon, I was in the park with my wife and our son, Nate, who at that time was just a toddler. And usually I felt very uncomfortable, you know, out in open spaces. And I just felt completely in the moment and even, and I was like real, the sort of inner happiness and well-being just in the first day after one meditation. My wife, who knew me very well, instantly decided she wanted to learn also, but she had to wait until next time a teacher came along. So that's how I got into it. And my interest in the collective effects actually goes back to childhood. When I was about maybe 9 or 10 years old, one of my Aunt Ski, my mother's younger sister, was a college-age lady, and she was a very flashy, kind of pretty girl, and she drove around in a pink convertible. Anyway, she came home one day really excited. She said she was sitting at the Oasis drive-in, and she felt like somebody's attention was on her, but she couldn't see who it was. She and her girlfriends were sitting in the convertible. And finally, she saw this guy sitting on the other side of the parking lot looking at him with the binoculars. And she was so amazed that you could feel the attention of someone else. And her excitement and all of that sort of really made me pay attention. And so became aware at that time that, you know, people really do feel the influence of other people, that there's this connection between people, besides the usual perceptual, you know, channels of communication that we have. And fast forwarding, we did research on this and all of that. And when I was teaching a class on collective consciousness, I'd always begin with asking the students, you know, have you ever had any experience like this? I would tell the experience of Aunt Ski and other ones. I had a friend who used to stare at the back of people's heads until he turned around and looked and things like that. And almost everybody had a story to tell, you know. Like I remember one story, one girl said that she had a dream about her father who was in Russia. She was in the United States at the time. and that he had gotten ill, and certain things had happened to him, and a brother who was in Europe had the same dream at the same time. It all came out to be true. So there are these connections between people like that. And one thing that's happening now in the world is that there's an increasing research interest in this phenomenon, not just what we're doing, looking at the collective effects of transcendental meditation on the whole society, but there are a lot of people doing research on the connection between different people. You know, for example, of an experiment, they'll have some sitting in a room looking at a monitor which is measuring the heart rate of another person in another room. And the person on a random schedule will say, okay, they will be instructed, okay, now try to raise that person's heart rate during this period. Now try to lower it during this period, you know, back and forth. And they get significant effects. It's been shown that negative effects can be transmitted. For example, anxiety, you try to make someone feel anxious, and then sure enough, they show these kind of stress responses. Or between people where there's some kind of coherent feeling, like between a therapist and someone that he feels completely compatible with, one of his clients, it's been shown that measuring their brain activity using magnetic resonance imaging, that there are these correspondences happen between people. So anyway, the point is that there are now hundreds of experiments out there that demonstrate this principle that people do interact with each other, which everybody has experienced in one way or another. And when you put all those interactions together, that's what Maharishi would call collective consciousness. Someone's driving, you know, you can imagine if in a laboratory where they say, okay, try to make someone more anxious or have some feeling toward compassion towards someone, and they can show some effect. In an artificial situation like that, if they can show effects, imagine what happens in real life situations where someone's in road rage and rah, rah, rah. You know, these things are shooting throughout society, coursing through it. And if the majority of the people are stressed, the sum effect of all of that is going to be stress and collective consciousness. And all of us, besides the target people of those particular emotions, but all the rest of us are going to be influenced by it. Mm-hmm. It just makes a lot of sense from, you know, from our personal experience, from the kind of individual research that's going on. And sure enough, Maharishi from the very beginning has said that in addition to the individual effects of meditation, that when you become more coherent in your own thinking and feeling, then your contribution to the totality of society, to the collective consciousness of society, is going to be more coherent, and you're going to have an influence on everybody else. And the good news is that the effect of coherence is more powerful than incoherence. You know, you need only the square root of 1% of people meditating, becoming more coherent, to have an influence to override the negative influence of, say, 99% of the other people in society. So I think I might be jumping ahead here, but...
Well, that 1% study, how did that begin? And, I mean, the number just right out of the air, I always wondered, you know, was this Maharishi's idea? Did he ask did some of the research be done on it?
Well, yes. You can say that it's an empirically confirmed estimate that originally Maharishi just, you might say, cognized that it's from his level of consciousness. But there's also a principle in physics that coherence is more powerful than incoherence. It's just that you can say formally that the effects of the coherent elements in society is proportional to their number squared, whereas everybody else's coherence is just proportional to their number. So if you have 100 men pulling on a rope, but they're sort of randomly, some are pulling this way and some are pulling that way, their influence can be overrode by only 10 people pulling together in the same direction. That would be like the coherent pulling. So that's the principle, and it's found in all levels of nature, that this principle of coherence. And in fact, quantum mechanics tells us that the universe is on its basis is really based on coherence. It may get quite incoherent and chaotic looking on the surface level, but on its very basis, coherence is the actual principle that structures the universe.
Now, that study, I know it has a lot to do with the effects of TM and the performance in the individuals when they perform TM and how it collectively affects the whole society. Who were the principal researchers on that project?
Well, originally it was discovered by Garland Landreth, who was in the psychology department at MIU, as it was called at that time, Marshall University of Management now. And but before that, Marshy had started a campaign in England, and the people in England were very skeptical and said, oh, you know, you can't get everybody to meditate. Very few want to meditate. So then he came up with a program, okay, 1 in 100. You know, you just find one person to meditate, and you don't have to meditate. One person will take care of 99 others. So Garland Landreth took it to heart to look into this 1% principle. And so he looked at the statistics of some cities here in the Midwest. It was like Ames, Iowa, and Iowa City, and Lawrence, Kansas. There was another one I can't remember at the moment, which had reached 1% of their population learning transcendental meditation at that time, which was in about 1974. And what he found was, as lo and behold, the crime rate decreased in those cities compared with other cities of also in the similar geographic region, you know, which would have similar kinds of influences at similar levels of crime rate initially. And so compared with the prior trends of those cities that reached 1%, their crime went down. They were going up, up, up year by year, and suddenly they started going down. The control cities just kept going up, up, up. So that experiment was then expanded into looking at all of the cities at a certain size, they were all small cities because the big cities hadn't reached 1% yet. And it was found to be true of all of them. And then Dr. Michael Dobek really expanded the research by looking at a random sample of all of the cities in the United States, stratified. So he had a sample of the biggest, very largest cities like New York and Chicago and all those, and then medium-sized cities, small cities. And what he found was, is that over the years, if you looked at it over the years, as the proportion of meditators increased in an area, at that year and following years, crime rate would begin to decrease. So it was a very powerful study because it took into account the entire United States. He actually measured half of the urban population of the United States in these different studies, and that was published in a good journal, that research. So this was one of the first studies that actually kind of demonstrated the idea of causality. One idea of causality is that the cause should come ahead of the effect. So if crime rate increased and then, say, the number of meditators increased after it or some scenario like that, that would be reverse causation. But the pattern that it showed was that it was the rise in meditators in the different urban areas. It was followed in time by the decrease in crime rate. And he was also in that study able to control for a large number of demographic variables which are known to influence crime. So that's like one of the most potent ones is the proportion of males, you know, young males from about 19 to 25. They seem to be the most rambunctious, and it's a very powerful, that's one powerful indicator of crime rate or predictor of crime rate. Economic situation is another, you know, under hard times when there's a lot of poverty and people are out of jobs and very needy, then the crime rate may rise. So he was able to control for those variables and show that even though some of those variables themselves have a significant effect, which is no big news, people had already known that, but when you statistically removed those other influences, there was still a very statistically significant independent effect of the number of meditators in the population.
I know there were some significant studies done with large groups of meditators, and one was, I think, in 1994 in Washington, D.C. I don't know if you were a part of that study or not. But and also in war-torn areas, pockets of meditators would be sent nearby, and it was shown that they would influence the whole war situation in that area. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The way that came about was that in 1978, Marshy had the idea of an ideal society campaign during the summer. A lot of TM teachers were not in school or teaching, and they were free to go places. And so large teams were sent to different provinces or states in different countries throughout the world. And the idea was to inspire the government and the people there to get 1% of their population meditating in order to create a more ideal society. But what was found in that was that just the groups of teachers together, and by that time they were also practicing the more powerful TM City program, that they alone, in groups like that, had an effect on the whole society. So the idea came then that maybe we don't even have to get 1% of the people in the population to meditate. We can even have groups of the square root of 1% of the population. You could even create a group somewhere, and that would have an influence. So that later that fall, there were a lot of trouble spot areas in the world, five major ones, but in Central America and Nicaragua in particular, they were having a revolution, and in the Middle East, as usual, and Southeast Asia and Rhodesia and Zimbabwe. So Marshy had the idea, well, if we can create coherence by having a group meditate together, why not send groups of siddhas to these trouble spot areas and see what happens. And it sort of came about very innocently, as Marshy's programs often did. It was someone read to Marshy a newspaper article, and it was some person in Nicaragua, it was in the paper, some simple person said, if anyone can help, please help. And Marshy said, okay, let's do it, you know. So anyway, so groups were sent to Central America and to into the Middle East and to these five trouble spot areas of the world. And what was found was that things began to calm down. You know, the newspapers would say that in Nicaragua, for example, the government is now giving amnesty to the rebels, and things are beginning to return to normal and so forth. But besides these reports in the newspapers and things, you know, more subjective kinds of things, we were able to get hold of a database called the Conflict and Peace Database, which was put together by a professor at the University of Maryland, completely independently of any of our research and not even with any knowledge of what we were doing. And so we got this database which measures the different kinds of interactions between countries. The sort of level of war, which was scaled, you know, and the level of intensity, as well as the kinds of verbal interactions, whether they were hostile or peaceful, as well as the kinds of things that the different countries were interacting on, whether it was about war or whether it was about cultural exchanges or about education or about health or about things like other things besides war. And what we found looking at that database was during this period of the World Peace Project, when these groups were in these trouble spot areas, that there was a reduction in conflicts, a marked reduction in conflicts between the different countries, and a reduction, and there was an increase, interestingly, in the positive kinds of interactions with about culture and education and things like that. So it wasn't just that the Marshy Effect was reducing fighting and negativity, it was increasing other kinds of positive things going on. So that was just one more. That I've talked about two experiments. There are now 51 research experiments on the Marishi Effect. And most of them have that kind of pattern where you create a group in an area and it has a calming influence, and when the group leaves, then the things revert back to the way they were before. One of the most famous studies was the one that was done in Israel by Dr. Skip Alexander, and I was also part of that. And we created a group in Jerusalem, and we showed over a two-month period, as the size of the group got larger or smaller, the quality of life in Israel and the war in Lebanon fluctuated correspondingly. You know, the larger the group, the less the war, the higher the quality of life, which means the fewer crimes, fewer fires, a more positive national mood, and some other measures. And we were able to show that other kinds of factors could not explain the results. You know, some critics said, well, there were different things happened at that time. The prime minister resigned. There are weekends, of course, when, you know, things could get better and so forth. And so we studied that and in a number of different ways. But I think the most convincing way is that when we removed those days from the data, for example, we just looked at weekdays and not weekends, took it out, took out the weekends, still, just looking at weekdays, on those days when they were a bit larger group of TM and TM City participants, things got better, and when the group was smaller, things, you know, reverted back and got worse. So there's been some very controlled experiments, and there's been controversy in the literature. People, are, of course, are trying to explain it away. Science doesn't like to take on a whole new paradigm without trying to disprove it. And people have been trying to disprove these experiments now for years and have not come up with, you know, a good alternative explanation. And you mentioned the study in Washington, D.C. That was another high-profile study where we predicted in advance what we expected would happen, which was a 20% reduction in violent crime in Washington, D.C. during this time. A large group was assembled. We had a project review board of independent scientists who came, and actually some of them came and looked in the room where everybody flew together to see that actually it was happening, and there were people sitting on the foam and all of that. And they advised us on measures, and they overlooked the whole process from beginning to end. And some of them were actually co-authors on the study. And again, we found that when the group reached the sufficient size, that the crime rate decreased compared with what it was doing before and what would be predicted to happen at that time based on things that influence crime, like the temperature. Temperature is one thing, you know, when it gets hot, violent crime goes up. We know from Ayurveda that it increases pitta. But another reason is that during the summer, there's more people, more kids, boys in particular, out of school on the streets. People are sitting around. They're hot. They're, you know, they're on vacation, and then there's more likely to be fights and things like that. But anyway, controlling for those kinds of influences, we saw that there was an independent influence of the size of the TM City group on reducing the crime rate in Washington, D.C.
Those are all amazing studies, and I guess the one fly in the ointment is that whenever the groups dispersed, it just all went back to pandemonium in the different places, and it was hard to convince people because of that. And maybe, Alex, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the Invisible America course is all about, why these people are coming together, and how its influence on the United States is expected to be.
Thanks, Dan. So the research that David has been describing, as he mentioned, 51 projects now and quite a large number of published studies, really made it clear that we had the technology to improve the quality of life, not only for communities and cities, but also for nations and the entire world. And Maharshi, in 2006, began a program for establishing invincibility for every nation. Actually, he had been doing this all along, but he really formalized it at that time, and began in Holland with a group that equaled the square root of 1% of the Dutch population in the early spring of 2006. And at that time, immediately, changes began to take place in Dutch society. And Maharshi also began the process of inspiring the same kind of group to form in the United States. And so on July 23rd, 2006, the Invincible America Assembly was established, and Maharshi put his direct attention on the creation of that group and wanted it to be, unlike all of the other projects that had preceded it, something that was sustained over time. Because as you mentioned, when the numbers dropped, we started to see the reverse phenomena. We would see a degradation in the quality of life, an increase in conflict. And so the Invincible America Program Assembly began at that time and grew over the fall, with the initial goal of reaching 2,000 participants on a regular basis, mornings and evenings, and from there ultimately to reach 8,000, but with the next stage at 2,500. And what Maharshi said was that when our numbers are 2,000, we will start to see the desired results. And what we've found is that our numbers reach 2,000 continuously in the summertime for periods of 2, 3, 4 weeks, and very dramatic changes take place during those times when our numbers reach 2,000, even just an evening program. And David has been keeping track of those kinds of things personally, as I have, and it's just, there's no question that a very positive development start to take place within the nation as a whole and globally. And I'll give you some examples. So this summer, when our numbers reached 2,000, we're all familiar with the extreme environmental degradation of the BP oil well spill, the Deepwater Horizon oil well spill. 86 days of failed attempts to stop that spill. When our numbers reached 2,000, 7 days in a row, on July 15th, that well was successfully capped. And that cap held. And it's very interesting for me to think about the Marshy's comment, the desired effects. Because if our nation has shared one common desire over the last quite a few years, it's, I don't think there have been very many Americans, if any, that have wanted to see that well go uncapped. It was a collective desire, and that desire got fulfilled. Another thing that happened during the same period of time was that we've been at war for 10 years now. It was continuous military engagement for 10 years. And what we found is that our war efforts, there's been all kinds of mixed media reports, but the reality is that we have not been successful, no matter what kind of spin we want to put on it. Most recently in Afghanistan, where we've been since 2004 continuously, is that our war efforts have been getting different kinds of approaches or strategies or all the rest. But during the time that we had 2,000 people assembled in the dome this summer, a leak of U.S. Army reports, classified reports, 96,000 pages documenting the actual developments within the war and our current status through 2009 were released to the media. New York Times, Der Spiegel, The Guardian received that information, evaluated it for its validity, its verifiability, and determined that it had to be brought to the public's attention. And that resulted in a completely radical shift that's now ongoing in terms of a much more objective public assessment of the value of that war, you know, and what we're really accomplishing. That took place when our numbers were at 2,000. And another thing that took place when our numbers were at 2,000 this summer was that the total amount of private giving commitment to charity doubled from $300 billion to $600 billion. And that occurred at the inspiration of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates in their Giving Pledge program, which they inaugurated on June 15th, which was the time in which our numbers were at 7,000. They had been planning it before, but they inaugurated it at that time. And during the ensuing 6 weeks, 40 billionaires signed on to the Giving Pledge, and the total amount of money available to private charities has doubled in 6 weeks. So these are just a sample of the kinds of effects. And David, you have some others that you've been looking at that would be interesting.
Yes,
to hear
I got an email recently that CNN was having a lot of difficulty now because there were so few breaking events now. There used to be so much stuff going on, and everybody was glued to it. In 1990, during the Gulf War, there were a billion people watching CNN. And just things are much more peaceful now. Actually, the world is at there's more peace in the world now than there has been any time in its recent history. Mm-hmm. Another study that was done was on the level of happiness in the world. This is a database that had been kept from 1946, and they expected in their most recent report in 2007, which was after the Invincible America Assembly started, that there would be a decrease in happiness because worldwide economic trends were very bad, and usually happiness drops when the economy is bad. But much to their surprise, there was a sharply rising trends of happiness worldwide, contrary to the hypothesis that economic trends would cause a decrease. So that was really quite amazing. And another example of changes that have happened since the Invincible America Course Assembly is that the crime rate in the United States has dropped very markedly, you know, and throughout the United States and in the major cities. So so there, the times are changing.
Even despite the economic downturn.
That's right. They were expecting that the crime rate would increase, but in fact, it's been decreasing. And for this economic terrible economic situation, somehow amazingly the country's holding on. It keeps on going. People are not wildly panicking. You know, a little bit of panicking, and the stock market, you know, drops, but then they kind of cool out, and it comes back, and so things have been kind of holding their own, which is quite unusual for it to be so stable in such a economically trying time.
And additional elements to this is that, especially in Latin America, there have been a large number of invincibility groups established in Mexico, in Ecuador, in Colombia, in Brazil. And so these programs are now catching on in greater and greater number and with more effectiveness. So what we're seeing in terms of the effects in the United States and also globally is a cumulative effect of the increasing numbers of people participating in these programs. And what's really significant is that we have, science has been kind of dragging its heels to catch on to the work that David and his colleagues have done. But Marshy never was one to wait. So he just decided to go ahead and full bore implement these programs and wait for science to catch up. And so now what we have is invincible defense technology adopted by the military of several countries, you know, where they have recognized the value of this technology, not only for their internal coherence within the nation, but also for their relationship with their neighbors. And very specifically, countries like Peru and Ecuador have engaged in that process to create coherence within their nations and utilizing government employees and military personnel for that purpose. And this, the whole history of this process of transformation is so phenomenal. The history of it, we'll get into that with future programs. But where we have presidents of nations that have intentionally put the program into effect and seen radical changes in their nation and in civil war and all the rest, and President Chissano in Mozambique, and it's an extremely exciting process that's underway. And we're in a position to not only know that it's happening, be able to watch it happen, but participate in bringing it about. And all of those elements combined make for a lot of good feeling, a lot of jazz, you know. And so, David.
Yes, people also ask, well, what about Fairfield? You know, you're talking about happiness worldwide and crime rate countrywide, but what about Fairfield? Isn't the crime rate going up or something like that? You hear this on some internet blocks. And I did a study from 1974 to 2005 and found that the Fairfield crime rate was 90% lower than other small towns of the similar size, 10,000 or less, in the United States. So that's a pretty good track record. And I was sitting at a concert night before last next to a non-meditating Iowan. And the person was saying how great, how wonderful Fairfield was. They were thinking of moving here. And this person said that Fairfield is the top tourist destination in Iowa now, according to the Iowa government. I haven't verified that statistic, but that's what she said. And so that's pretty amazing. Yeah, Fairfield, I can tell you from being away from Fairfield for a number of years and coming back, it's just totally amazing here.
And you can be certain that statistics will be verified given David's scientific nature.
Well, this all sounds very promising. I keep thinking about the individual in this equation. I mean, he certainly is going to benefit just as much as society, and probably even, I mean, it's so much worth as while as an individual to join this group of peacemakers and to bring coherence into society. And David, you probably have some thoughts about how individuals can benefit from being involved in this program. And you too?
Yes, it's a numbers game, and we want to have over 2,000 for sure, and 2,500. And
The thing is, it should be easy to do. There's about 1,000 of you guys out there who are not coming to program.
Regularly.
and it makes a difference. So even if of the people who are siddhas are 2,000, Alex is saying, that are in the community, even if they came one or two times to the group program, that would put us over 2,500 on a regular basis. It would be a very simple thing to do. So if you can't do it yourself, get two of your friends to come.
That's right. We've looked at the numbers, and it looks like if everyone were just to commit to being in group program two more times per week than where they are now, then that would do it. And, you know, we recognize everybody's needs are completely different. You know, we have all professional requirements, family requirements, just hobbies and all the rest. So what we need to do is think of ourselves as a group. And if we work together as a group and we just make individual commitments to just a little bit more than what we're doing now, we'll be there. And the results it'll be marvelous to see as they come.
And the side benefits are better health, feeling good, better relationships. I mean, the whole gamut.
And more money.
More money. Usually we say it the other way around. You meditate for your personal health and happiness and inner serenity and all that, and the side product is world peace.
Yeah, there we go.
But if you want to come for world peace, then you'll get those other things.
I think there's a big factor here that I think is extremely important, and that is the nature of the global environment. You know, we're in a situation now where the degradation to our environment is, everybody or almost everyone recognizes its critical nature. But there's so many different opinions about how to solve the problem. Even amongst environmentalists, there's lots of differences. And the key element that we accomplish with our group program is that coherence that David was talking about, where people are able, their collective consciousness is more coherent, which facilitates better communication, more creative thinking, more receptivity to new ideas, more purposeful focus in terms of accomplishing the task, better ability to recognize the situation as it is. And that's what we need now. We need it desperately, because we have a problem globally that if we don't address it in this period of time, it's going to be increasingly difficult to address it. At least that's the sense that we have from the people most concerned. And so by contributing to group program, we accomplish not only for society, but for nature as a whole. And this is one of the really interesting things about the research that's been going on. David, you might want to talk a little bit about the random number generator that was snuck into the dome and no, without anybody knowing about it, and the result from that study.
Well, there's been a research project going on at Princeton for some time showing that people can put attention onto these random number generators and actually have an influence, and that there are group influences. This is done by Roger Nelson and his group at Princeton, and they've deployed these random generators in 50 different places around the world in one kind of experiment. They've done many experiments, and they've shown that when people are focusing their attention on a common thing, like a world football match, or like Princess Di's funeral, about a billion people, I think, were watching that on TV, that these generators become non-random. It's hard. There's no real explanation or good theory for why they should, but the principle is that human consciousness can have an influence on inanimate nature. There's not anything much more inanimate than a random generator. And so I got this email from one of my Purusha friends when we first started the Invincible America course. Actually, it was after 9/11, yeah. And he said, Why don't you see, and we created a big group in response to that. Why don't you see if the random generators are influenced by our group? And so I got in contact with Roger Nelson, who's a friend of mine, and he said, okay, make some specific predictions. Exactly, you know, when you think, and when is your program, and exactly, you know, when do you think the maximum effect is going to be, and so forth. And he did that study, and he repeated it again later, and he found that during those times when we were doing our
program that there was an influence on the random generators. There was also an influence of the 9/11 attack, which is quite amazing. And the interesting thing is our influence is in the opposite direction of these negative things, like the 9/11 attack. So we're apparently we're having an influence on inanimate nature, which from a quantum mechanical point of view makes sense that our individual existence seems to be localized at a particular point in time and space, like I'm sitting here in Fairfield talking to this microphone and next to my friends here. But each of us have this sort of localization, but our wave functions actually exist everywhere in the universe to some extent. And ultimately, we're all different points of kind of focus of this one infinite, unbounded, extended field, unified field. So even on the point of view of the electromagnetic field, we're just sort of points on that. And so we're all connected at the basis. And so if we can create coherence on that deep basis, we're going to create coherence throughout the entire system.
And this is the paradigm shift that's taking place now, is from the perspective of the point value to the field value, and then the recognition that the field is consciousness. There was a Nobel laureate physicist who visited MIU in the early 80s, Eugene Wigner, and he's an author of a book titled Symmetries and Reflections. And I'm paraphrasing a quote from his book, but I really like it. He said that no matter how our understanding of the physical world may develop, it'll forever be remarkable that we've come to the realization that consciousness is an ultimate reality. And so what we are is we're technologists of consciousness. We know how to operate within consciousness to create the desired effects, and the desired effects are for the benefit of all of society, all of nature, the entire universe.
Alex mentioned the random generator in the dome, and I didn't get to that one. So this was done by one of our PhD students, or actually PhD graduates, Lynn Mason. Lynn Mason, you might recall, or maybe not, did the research on cosmic consciousness, and she found that people who had experiences of witnessing throughout the night sleep, which is a sort of acid test of cosmic consciousness, that pure consciousness is maintained throughout the night. She found that their EEG signature showed that you would see the signature of sleep, and superimposed upon that was a signature of transcending. But anyway, so Lynn's a very creative person, and so she had the idea of putting one of these random generators in the ladies' dome, unbeknownst to the people who were practicing their program. And what she found was is that during different parts of the program, there were effects on the random generator. For example, when they were meditating, there was an effect. And during yogic flying, there was like three times the effect. It was just what we would predict from our theory. Really amazing. And she published that in the Journal of Scientific Exploration a couple of years ago. So that was the story of the random generator in the dome. She also found that there was an effect of the Vedic Observatory on the random generator, which was very interesting.
I guess reading Vedic texts also has the same effect, is that right?
Right. And to broaden it out, really, people ask, is meditating the only way to create coherence and collective consciousness? I would say no. I say the brain is always transcending. That's what it does. Whenever someone hears poetry and then they have that aha experience at the end of the thing, it creates some transcending, and my wife Rhoda and I actually did a pilot experiment some years ago where we hooked up people to an EEG machine and we were measuring their respiration, and I had a recording of her reading some very cosmic poetry, which would end with some, unusual thing would happen at the end that you weren't expecting, and the person goes, oh, like that. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, their respiration would slow down, their brain would become more coherent. So I think that the arts have been creating coherence in society all along, and to the degree that society has been held together, it's been by the arts. I think science may create a little bit of coherence, maybe, but I think mainly it creates strain in the brain. Maybe for the scientists, when they discover something, there's this great aha experience with Einstein, figuring out relativity, and it has a great effect on society. Mm-hmm. But I think more powerful than that is people listening to symphonies or music, and they get into that space where they're sort of synchronized with each other, and it's in a, you know, very powerful, creating a very powerful effect. But the uniqueness, I think, of Marshi's program is it goes right to the basis. It's not just in the direction, but it goes right to the basis of creating coherence in the transcendent, and that's the most powerful way to do it. And the good news is that as coherence rises, all of these other techniques will also work, function better. You know, the peace in the world is created by the peacemakers. Anything that happens, reduced crime, it'll have an explanation on the behavioral level. It's like if you have iron filings on a sheet of paper, then you run a magnet underneath, they're all running around. They have this behavioral explanation, but the deeper thing is what's happening underneath. But so coherence in society will be helping all of those people throughout the world who are trying to create peace, who are trying to donate, you know, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, you know, to do better in the world. All of those different processes are going to be helped by creating coherence on the very basic level through meditation. It's so amazing that in meditation you do nothing. There's nothing practical about it. Some other forms of meditation, you're practicing focusing, and yes, you get better at focusing. During TM, you're practicing doing nothing, and you get everything. I mean, everything comes out of it, and not only for the individual, but it's creating this coherence in society, which is increasing the effectiveness of all positivity throughout society.
Alex, maybe you know this, but to join the Invisible America courses is still a viable thing. People can sign up, and are positions available for them?
There's a number of aspects to the Invisible America Assembly, but in terms of participating in the Super Radiance program, it's just a matter of simple application if people aren't already qualified to be in the dome, and that's very easy, very, very efficient. And then for those who would like financial support and do the additional rounding that the Invincible America Assembly involves, the Howard and Alice Settle Foundation has been extremely generous in making financial support available, and that can information on that can be obtained at the InvincibleAmerica.org website. And I'd also like to mention, David was talking about the role of a scientist and the artist, and David's quite an artist as well, so he walks in both paths.
Yeah, I have to create some coherence after all that science. And by the way, Dr. Ken Kavanaugh has also done some excellent research on the effects of the Marshi effect on the economy, and Dr. Rachel Goodman has done research showing that when the coherence numbers are higher, that there is increased cooperation in government. And Dr. Paul Gelderlos, I should mention, has done some research showing that when we had our large assemblies in the mid-80s of over 7,000 in the United States and in Holland and in Washington, D.C., that the relationships between the United States and the Soviet Union totally softened at that time. So these studies that I've mentioned, as well as many others, are on my website and discussed in detail, and that is truthabouttm.com. So truthabouttm.com, truthabouttm, one stringed out word, and then .com. And so I not only do I discuss, I have all of the different research sort of summarized in some papers. You can download PDFs, but there's also positive things, you know, like reviews of the research, and there are letters from various religious leaders from various faiths saying, you know, their positive experiences with meditating, and various kinds of discussions and positive things, as well as talking about all the negativity that you might come across on the web about TM, having answers to those different things.
David's list of publications on his website is 16 pages worth of stuff.
It's a very informative website. If you want some eye-opening information, just go to his website. Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming in, Dr. David Orm Johnson and Alex Green, and for giving us a little insight into the Invisible America course and what we can expect from that if we all go to program on time.
Just two more times a week. That's all it takes.
That's right. And we have more. We have other guests that Alex is going to be hosting on this program. And Alex, you want to mention a few names?
We're speaking with Dr. Carla Brown, who's looked at the resistance within the scientific community and the media to this information, so we could take a look at how that's been dealt with. And then Robert Oates has agreed to speak, and we'll just see what how many we can invite to who can have the time to do it. But I think it's just really important for us as a community to understand the power of the technology that we have and to use it properly.
So thank you for joining us on KHOE's What's New on Campus, and please join us again on future programs coming up soon with Alex Green hosting. Please join us again.
So what do you think?